Welcome to the second mind-twisting episode of Cryptid Conversations.
We are your dark demon hostesses, Bethany
and JC.
Today, we will be covering the topic of witches and dark magic
through examining cultural patterns, documents, journals, and psychology
to better understand human-derived fear.
And here is Bethany sharing her creepy stories and tales regarding the supposed witches and their trials that occurred in Salem, Massachusetts.
The Salem witch trials consumed the lives of early colonists in the Massachusetts area between the years 1692 and 1693, beginning with unexplainable occurrences to paranoia to blatant accusations. In order to fully understand why the Salem witch trials began, I would like to touch on the Christian and other religious beliefs that the devil offers certain people, or so-called witches, with the power to harm others in exchange for their unceasing loyalty. Such beliefs reached a high point during the so-called witch craze that erupted in Europe in the 1300s and ended in the late 1600s. During this 300-year period, thousands of witches, that were most commonly women, were executed on the basis that they were the devil's pawns. Just as the European craze began to wind down, the Salem witch trials started to gain momentum in the colonies as a result of local pressures. In the year 1689, English rulers known as William and Mary started a war with France in the 13 English colonies. This is later called King Henry's War. This conflict forced many refugees to abandon their homes in the county of Essex and move to areas in the Massachusetts Bay Colony, including Salem Village. The large influx of refugees then put a strain on already limited resources in the village and created an even greater rift between wealthy port families and agricultural families, because port families were unable to make a large profit off of meager resources sent to them by farmers. Limited resources were not the only negative factor changing the daily lives of Salem inhabitants. With controversy stewing around Reverend Samuel Parris's greedy and rigid nature, such conflict in the small village made Puritans begin to believe that the devil was meddling in their lives. In January of 1692, Reverend Parris's daughter Elizabeth and niece Abigail Williams experienced fits in which they would scream, throw objects, utter peculiar words, and contort themselves into strange positions. Another young girl named Anne Putnam experienced similar episodes. When the young girls were examined by the local doctor, he diagnosed them with bewitchment. Two men named Jonathan Corwin and John Hawthorne later blamed three women for inflicting the fits on the girls. They were Tituba, the Parris' Caribbean slave, Sarah Good, a homeless beggar, and Sarah Osborne, a poor elderly woman. All the accused were of low social status in the community that were often considered to be untrustworthy. After such accusations, the three women were brought before local civil officers or magistrates and questioned for several days, beginning on March 3rd of 1692. Both Good and Osborne pled not guilty, while Tituba confessed. She stated that the devil had come to her in search of followers, and that she had indeed signed a book when asked by a quote-unquote black man. She also described elaborate images of black dogs, red cats, and yellow birds. She claimed that witches were dispersed throughout Salem with hopes in destroying the Puritans. Many accusations followed, as the three initially accused women were thrown in jail. This included a loyal member of the church called Martha Corey. Those arrested spread much concern, as anyone could be a witch if one so pure was convicted. Also, Sarah Good's 4-year-old daughter Dorothy was accused of being a witch, as a result of her timid responses to the magistrate's questions. In May of 1692, Governor William Phillips established Dyer and Terminar courts that would hear and decide on cases of witchcraft. The person brought to trial in the special court system was Bridget Bishop, who was an older woman known to gossip and be disloyal to her partner. She claimed to be innocent, yet was convicted and became the first person hanged on Gallows Hill. 5 days after the hanging of Bridget Bishop, Minister Cotton Mather denounced the use of spectral evidence, or evidence pertaining to dreams or visions, in the special court. Yet his request was ignored, and five more women were convicted and hanged on the basis of being witches. The father of Minister Cotton Mather, named Increase Mather, the president of Harvard University, later followed his son in recommending they stop using spectral evidence in trials. He was known for saying that it was better that suspected witches roam free than innocent people be hanged on the basis of unjust accusations. After hearing Mather's plea, and his own wife being questioned for using witchcraft, Governor William Phillips dissolved the court of Oyer and Terminer and replaced it with a superior court, which did not permit the use of spectral evidence, on October 29, 1692. Three out of the remaining 56 witches were found guilty. He also released many accused witches and later pardoned them in May of 1693. Yet 19 women had already been hanged on Gallows Hill, along with an elderly man who had been pressed to death by stones, and those that had passed away in jail awaiting trial. 256 years after the Salem witch trials, the state of Massachusetts formally apologized for the events, as the subject reignited the interest of the American public. For instance, in 1953, author Miller constructed an allegory play known as The Crucible, in which the trials acted as an abstract rendering of McCarthyism in the 1950s that created paranoia on the basis of communist infiltration of the U.S. government. Many studies were also conducted in the 20th century to better understand the causes for the afflicted children's fits. The most conclusive study was conducted by psychologist Linda Caporale. She blamed the odd behaviors exhibited by the inhabitants of Salem on a fungus, yergot, and rye, wheat, and other cereal grasses. Eating such a fungus can cause muscle spasms, vomiting, delusions, and hallucinations that were all experienced by those supposedly diagnosed with bewitchment. The fungus thrives in warm and damp climates, such as the swampy meadows of Salem, where it would have been grown. We may never know what really occurred to the people of Salem, but this 1976 study is the closest to an answer that we may ever get.
Thank you for that very interesting backstory of the Salem witch trials. So I have a couple questions for you.
Oh, sure.
Where do you think that the idea of bewitchism and people being witched happened?
Well, I think back in those days, we didn't have a lot of answers. I mean, when you think about it, we have learned so much in the past 100 years. And at that time, we didn't have technology that would truly aid in determining the causes of illnesses. So I think people with religion, such a cornerstone in their daily lives, chose to take the stories of the Bible and really make them guide their everyday lives, right? So with the devil spoken of in the Bible, they might think when someone's ill, it's the devil, right? And I think that just, it continued throughout that era until we began to learn more about the world.
Why do we think that people might have confessed to such a thing when there was no way to tell if they really were a witch? And most of the time, people were actually proven innocent, but still confessed. Why would somebody confess such a thing?
At the time, it was actually easier to confess that you were a witch rather than to say that you were innocent. One really extreme example is that one way to determine that if a person was supposedly a witch is that they'd take them to a fast-moving river. And if you swam, you were called a witch, right? But if you drowned, you were told that you were innocent, right? Of course, that wouldn't save your life. So a lot of people, in order to save themselves, would probably say, "I am a witch." And with that, they would probably just receive some sort of help. They might be under like extensive care to sort of get that horrible energy out of them. And then they would be free to continue their daily lives with very small consequences in compared to other tests that they may be put through.
That makes a lot of sense then why one might confess to such a thing when We're not really sure what might have been going through their heads.
Exactly. And there was actually a movie made in the 1990s, and it was based on the play by Arthur Miller. And it was also called The Crucible. And in this play, you could see that the young girls would actually fake having fits and say, and they would just continue blaming like another person and another person for the fits afflicted upon them, just so that they would appear innocent. And you could see how people would really get caught up in that process and just continue blaming and blaming, and the snowball would just get bigger and bigger as the trials continued.
Thus becoming the witch hunt.
Exactly.
As people may call it today, where you constantly blame other people and it goes around in a circle like you explained.
Yeah, exactly. Just continues. And now JC will share her understanding of the way in which witches are portrayed and the rationale used to accuse them.
We have always heard about witches and that create potions, take the form of black cats, and how they trick children with their ways of using black magic. The way witches have been percepted in today's society have certainly changed from back in the 1600s, when there was multiple suspicions. But how come we still hear stories today about how people have been cursed? And why are we so suspicious about certain rituals that people have performed? Well, to all my cryptid listeners out there, I have the answers for you. Let's start off with the topic of what the main thing that witches use and how most people can classify a witch using black magic. The theory of witches and most types of magic all originated in Africa and African tradition. In fact, there are two types of magic, black magic and white magic. Black magic is defined as magic involving the supposed invocation of evil spirits for evil purposes. White magic, as you would imagine it, is the polar opposite, what most people would classify as good magic. Black magic is directed towards people in very negative ways that could lead to someone as simple as paranoia or even as bad as death. In Africa, anyone from the illiterate to highly intelligent believed that these types of magic were real. Eventually, the belief in these types of magic was spread through the majority of countries, causing multiple witch hunts as we have seen in the early days of America. There have still been cases of witchcraft and black magic suspected to this day. Witches have been believed to praise and worship Satan, and one of the things that Satan is said to have promoted is that nothing happens by chance, but by intention in some way. For example, let's say that you are going for a jog around your neighborhood. While you're running in the dark, clouds cover over the sky and it starts to downpour. You are having an extremely hard time seeing anything in front of you, and you trip over a rock and twist your ankle. You cannot walk on your ankle and you are stranded in the street during a thunderstorm. If you were suspicious enough and thought that all those were too coincidental, you may have thought that someone used witchcraft to send the storm over you and to place the rock in front of you that you tripped over. Putting thoughts like these into your head are sure to make you think that this incident was caused by witchcraft if you really completely accept it. Let's dig a bit deeper into this thought. If you refuse to believe that this event was just some random accident and continue to tell yourself that someone is out to get you, you'll eventually be 100% convinced that you are being targeted. The way this part of the brain works reacts the same with words you hear too. If you say or speak of the simple word retirement to a person or teen who has been overworked, they are almost guaranteed to slow down their effort and work progress. The same pattern is also recognized in many trials, especially murders, where the murderer repeats the correct story of what really happened to themselves over and over until they have convinced themselves that they did not murder the person, even though they truly did.
Oh, that was very interesting, and it really adds to that layer of the human mind and what we can convince ourselves if we really work hard enough, right?
Yes.
And I was just thinking, like, tying it back to the Salem witch trials, do you think that the people actually, like the murderer you described, they actually, like, dream and they just keep thinking that they actually saw, like, a witch come to them in their sleep, or the devil for that matter, to the point in which they actually believe it?
That's exactly what I believe happened. That, in fact, they might have been hallucinating or been overworked and tired and might have thought that they saw something, but they really didn't. And they constantly start repeating it and telling people and telling themselves that they're not crazy So they want to make excuses so that they don't look like they're crazy. So they constantly repeat this to themselves, that this is what truly happened, even though really it could not have been what happened. And eventually, your brain will stimulate that this is what really happened, and it'll push the truth off to the side.
Yeah, completely. And I think it's also a way to explain things that you don't understand. Because I know that black cats have always been, like, synonymous with, like, witches. And I wonder if that's sort of the same thing. Like, they're trying to convince themselves that there are witches out there and there is evil. So why don't we just use an actual object that we see every day and say that that's some sort of symbolism going on?
Exactly. And the same thing has been seen in back in the 1600s when the witch trials were going on, that you were not supposed to put a cat by a baby or a black cat because, in fact, the cat would lay on top of the baby, crush the baby, and quote unquote, suck the soul out of the baby. And if you really think about it, the only reason the cat would be sucking the soul from a life would be because it was a witch. So people believe that when they saw cats on top of babies, it's because they're sucking the soul out of them because they have lots more lives than the witch does. When really, multiple ways happen where there was lots of strays on the street, and the strays needed to be warm, and babies, of course, were very warm. So the strays would lay on top of the babies for warmth. But people would convince themselves, because the witch trials were going on at the time, that, in fact, that was a witch trying to take your baby's life.
Wow, that's really shocking, too, because there's completely, like, a list of logical explanations, like you're saying. Like, possibly the baby has food residue on its face, and the cat's trying to lick the food off the face. But they would jump to that conclusion just
exactly.
To convince themselves that there's something at work here that's not normal.
Yes.
And also through my research, I was looking at different things that would make a person a witch. And I found it really interesting how it was always like these polar opposites. Like one I can recall is that it would say, if you had too many children, you're a witch because you were supposedly stealing them from other people. And if you had too little children, it showed that you were sort of incompetent in some way, in that you were sort of using your magic to not have children at the same time. And it was also like that with social status. Like, the really poor people were often committed of being a witch because it was odd how they didn't have any money, right? And then if you had too much money, it's like you're stealing that. And it's just interesting how we create these beliefs just to cement this sort of abstract idea.
Yes, I agree. I feel that we also kind of see this trend today where you're looking for the perfect person. And if you're not the most perfect, normal person that's exactly like everybody else, you're considered weird or out of the ordinary, which is the same as you were just speaking of.
Yeah, exactly. And I really think it all boils down to, like, the way that you look at the world, the way that you look at yourself, all determines, like, your fear level, your confidence, and the people you're around also contributes to that as well.
I agree.
Before concluding this episode of Cryptid Conversations, I would like to describe an example of how one strain of paranoia could drive a once peaceful village to madness.
In this scenario, let's start with a very simple village with around 10 people or so, very small. Everybody knows everyone and everyone's pretty close.
Yeah, exactly. So let's say this one young girl decides to go to the woods. In this woods, she finds a vast array of chestnuts. She brings them home to her family. They're slightly hesitant of where this food came from, and they begin to question whether she stole them or did something else in order to gain them.
Yes, let's call this family the Clausen family. They're a very simple family. Everyone knows them. They raise cattle for the village, and they make stuff with wool for their farm and for everybody in the village. They're good suppliers, and everybody knows them. Now, their daughter, let's call her Katrina, she comes home with these nuts, as we described, and they are a little bit suspicious, but not too suspicious. They tell her to keep them in the bedroom and not to show anyone, because that might diminish the supply.
Then Katrina's friend, Mary, decides to pay a visit to her house, and they hope to knit with their new yarn. When Mary enters Katrina's bedroom, she sees the chestnuts strewn across her bed. She hasn't seen these type of nut in a very long time. And it's suspicious. Where did Katrina get these? She marvels over them, and then once Katrina re-enters the room, she begins to inquire her, "Where did you get these? What did you pay for these?" Katrina doesn't answer because she doesn't want to get in trouble because her parents had told her to stay quiet.
And then Mary goes home after they have their playdate, and she tells her parents all about these strange chestnuts that Katrina found. And Mary's parents start to get very concerned with how a sweet, innocent girl like Katrina might not be as sweet as they might think she is.
Exactly. And once Mary begins to tell the story, her parents are baffled beyond what Mary was when she first saw the chestnuts. And they decide to go to the house and ask them where they got these. When the parents are unsure, suspicion begins to flow around Katrina and the strange things that she gained in the forest. People say, did she steal them? Did she summon some kind of dark magic to get these? I mean, where are they from? People were baffled, and accusations were flying left and right as to where they came. And soon enough, Katrina was blamed for having used witchcraft of all things to create these chestnuts.
When in reality, Katrina was so confused as to why everybody was calling her a witch and saying that she used something such as witchcraft. Katrina was only 7 years old. She had no right with the devil. She was just an innocent girl who found these chestnuts in the woods and decided to bring them home to her family. And now, the whole village has turned on Katrina, and she doesn't know where to go from here. Even her own parents are concerned with where she got these chestnuts.
This is but one example of how one single action can cause a tight-knit society to explode with outlandish ideas and beliefs. This is a really simplistic example of how the Salem trials gained momentum in the 1600s when the talk of the devil was common.
This is also how fear drives people to jump to awkward conclusions that might not even make the most sense afterwards, but at the time, it's the only reasonable explanation they can think of. So they jump to it and they use it and they tell it to everybody as if it's fact.
And this is how fear in the eye of the beholder can captivate even the most pure minds.
Thanks for tuning in once again to this sinister second episode of Cryptid Conversations.
We hope to see you next time when we examine strange events in history and conspiracy theories.